ago. Mrs. Winship's eyes narrowed.
I'm quite aware of that. I sent a birthday card, remember?
Duane Sr. looked embarrassed. I told him to call you and say thanks for the check. I guess he forgot.
So you bought him a car?
No. Fixed up a motorcycle that we found in the one ads, Duane Sr. said. DJ has a fondness for motorcycles.
Oh, terrific. Next Christmas I'll get him a helmet, Mrs. Winship said. And some funeral insurance.
Duane Scrod Sr. frowned. Now why do you always have to take that snippy tone?
Why? Pourquoi? For whom?
Cried the macaw.
Listen to me, Duane, Mrs. Winship said forcefully. If I don't hear from my grandson soon, life will get extremely unpleasant for you. I'm not paying his tuition so that he can skip class and roast weenies in the woods. That's an insult to me, and I resent being insulted.
Duane Scrod Sr. flinched like a puppy that had just been smacked on the butt with a newspaper. He said, I'll do my best to find Junior.
Good idea, because I'm not leaving town until I see him, Mrs. Winship declared. Now give me a straight answer. Do you think he's the one who set fire to the swamp?
Truly, I couldn't say.
Why in the world would he do such a thing, Mrs. Winship said. Since you're the only other arsonist I know, I thought you might have some special insight.
Duane Sr.'s eyes flashed in anger.
I never taught that boy to set fires. He knows better. Then let's hope the police are wrong.
She was halfway down the steps when he called her name.
Hey, Millie, wait. What do you hear from Whitney?
The question made Millicent Winship's heart sink. She looked up at Duane Sr. and quietly said,
She's not coming back from Paris.
So the cheese business is good.
I'm sorry, I really am, said Mrs. Winship. By the way, your precious bird just pooped all over your shirt.
Duane Scrod Sr. looked down at the mess and nodded bleakly. What else is new, he said. On the same Monday morning that Nick had watched Smoke eat Mrs. Starch's pencil, Captain Gregory Waters was being evacuated from Iraq to an American military installation in Germany. From there, he was flown to the Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C., a hospital for soldiers. Nick and his mother flew up on Thursday morning and waited an hour in the lobby. Finally, a doctor came out and introduced himself. They followed him along a maze of drab corridors, teeming with nurses and orderlies and patients. Nick had never seen so many young men and women in wheelchairs. The doctor took Nick and his mother into a private room. Using a cross-section diagram of the human body, he explained that Captain Waters lost his right arm and most of the shoulder when something called a rocket-propelled grenade, or RPG, had struck the Humvee in which he was riding.
We know, Nick's mother said tightly. They phoned us from the base in Ramadi. Can we see him now?
Did they also tell you that because of the severe damage to the shoulder, we might not be able to fit your husband with a working prosthetic?
Like a mechanical hook, you mean?
It would be difficult, the doctor said. But we're not giving up hope.
Can we see him, please?
The doctor led them up a flight of stairs, then down another long corridor. Every patient they saw was missing an arm or a leg, sometimes both legs. Nick tried not to stare. Before entering his father's hospital room, he paused to brace himself. Captain Gregory Waters was propped upright in bed, though his eyes were closed. His chest, wrapped with gauze and heavy tape, moved up and down slightly when he breathed.
Nick noticed that his dad's hair had been shaved, and that one side of his face was pink and mottled with welts. A clear tube carried amber fluid into his remaining arm from a plastic bag strung on an aluminum rack beside the bed. Her eyes welling, Nick's mother stood wordlessly at the foot of the bed. She looked shaky, so Nick put an arm around her waist and walked her to the only chair in the room.
"He's still on lots of pain medication," the doctor said. "So he'll be groggy when he wakes up."
"Could you get my mom a glass of water?" Nick asked. After the doctor left, another long hour passed before Nick's father awoke. He smiled sleepily when he saw them. Nick's mother hugged him and stroked his face. Nick squeezed his left hand, and his father squeezed back firmly. Glancing at the bandaged knob where his right arm used to be, he joked,
"Now I'll have to sew up the extra sleeve in all my shirts."
Nick's mom said, "Very funny, Greg."
"So I'll have to learn how to throw a curve left-handed. No big deal."
Always a good athlete, Nick's father had been a pitcher in the Baltimore Orioles farm system when he'd first met Nick's mother. According to the newspaper clippings on a family scrapbook, Greg Waters' fastball had once been clocked at 94 miles per hour.
He'd never made the big leagues.
He'd gone back to college, earned a degree in business administration, and taken a desk job with a sprinkler supply company in Fort Myers. After 3 years of being bored out of his skull, he returned to baseball as a pitching coach for a minor league club. He was happy, but the money wasn't great. That's one reason he joined the National Guard. The sign-up bonus had paid for Nick's first year at the Truman School. For one weekend every month, Greg Waters went to Tampa to train as an Army soldier. The country was at peace, and neither he nor his family ever imagined that he'd be sent overseas to face real combat. Everything changed after the invasion of Iraq.
"Did they say when I can go home?" Nick's father asked.
"It all depends. Tomorrow you start rehab," Nick's mother said.
"What fun." Greg Waters blinked heavily. "I'm so damn tired."
Nick's gaze fell upon the rounded white knob of gauze and tape where his father's muscular right arm had once been. The bandages were so shiny that they looked fake, like part of a mummy costume for Halloween. His mom said, "Greg, you get some rest. We'll come back at dinner time."
"You're not going to try to feed me like a baby, are you?"
"No, sir.
You're going to feed yourself." "That's my girl." Nick's father grinned. "Nicky, you holding up okay?"
"I'm good, Dad."
"It's a rough deal, I know, but things could be worse," he said. "I was lucky to get out of that place alive. The guy sitting next to me in that Humvee, he didn't make it."
Nick felt his head start to spin. "Was he your friend?"
"Like a brother."
Nick lowered his eyes. It was almost unbearable to think how close his father had come to dying. When he looked up again, Captain Gregory Waters was fast asleep. After visiting Duane Scrod Sr., who was not especially helpful, Detective Jason Marshall picked up Dr. Dressler at the Truman School. And together, they went to the residence of Bunny Starch. The headmaster had requested to come along, which was fine with the detective. Walking up the creaking steps of the old house, Dr. Dressler exclaimed, "The rat's gone."
"What?"
the detective said. "She put a stuffed rat on that rocking chair," Dr. Dressler said. "She named it after one of her former students." Jason Marshall looked doubtful. "I'm serious," said Dr. Dressler. The detective knocked on Mrs. Starch's door. Nobody answered. He pressed the doorbell, but was out of order. They walked around to the other side of the house and rapped on the back door. Still no response.
Guess I'll come back tomorrow, Jason Marshall said.
Dr. Dressler was disappointed. Can't you just break in? What if she's ill or she had an accident or something else happened?
I can't go inside a house without a search warrant, the detective explained, and a judge won't give me a warrant unless there's cause to believe a crime's been committed. There's no evidence of that, Dr. Dressler.
Frustrated, the headmaster trailed Jason Marshall back to his unmarked police car.
That letter I got about a family emergency, I just don't buy it, Dr. Dressler said. The woman has no family that I can locate anywhere.
The detective leaned against the fender of his car and took out a pack of chewing gum. He offered a piece to Dr. Dressler, who said no thanks.
Libby's told me all the crazy stories about Mrs. Starch, Jason Marshall said. Kids love to talk. Normally I wouldn't pay much attention. Now you're telling me she kept a stuffed rat on the porch? This isn't the most normal person in the world, would you agree?
Dr. Dressler nodded.
She's a bit quirky, for sure.
Maybe she just freaked out after the fire on the field trip, the detective speculated. That had to be a scary experience. Eventually she finds her way out of the woods and rushes to our house with Libby's asthma inhaler. Then she drives home, looks in the mirror and says, "Geez, I could have died out there. I really need some time off."
Dr. Dressler was skeptical.
"Not Bunny Starch," he said.
"Imagine spending a night all alone in the big cypress while it's burning," Jason Marshall said. "I don't care how tough you are. It definitely would shake you up."
"Anything's possible, I suppose."
"Just a theory." Detective took out his cell phone. "What's the number at this house?"
But now the headmaster knew it by heart.
555-2346, he said.
Jason Marshall dialed and waited. Mrs. Starch's phone rang only twice before an answering machine picked up.
"There's a message," the detective whispered to Dr. Dressler. "What's it say?"
Jason Marshall touched the redial button and handed the cell phone to Dr. Dressler. The headmaster listened intently to the recorded greeting on the other end.
"Hello, people. I'll be away from school indefinitely because of an unexpected family matter. You may leave a message at the tone, though it might be a while before I have time to reply. Please accept my apologies in advance. Now here's the beep."
"Is that her voice?" the detective asked.
"Sure sounds like it," Dr. Dressler said.
"First the letter, now the voice message on her phone. I've got to be honest, there's nothing more the sheriff's office can do." "The woman is obviously alive and well," said Jason Marshall.
"Then why no phone calls?"
"Maybe she doesn't feel like answering questions about a family emergency. That doesn't really exist. Like I said, she probably just needed a break. So she made up an excuse not to come to school."
"But that's not like her," Dr. Dressler asserted again.
"Some people burn out on their jobs all of a sudden. I've seen it happen before."
The detective opened the car door and slid behind the wheel.
"Just a second," said Dr. Dressler.
He stepped quickly to Mrs. Starch's mailbox and peeked inside. It was empty. On the ride back to the Truman campus, the headmaster asked Jason Marshall about the arson investigation. The detective said he turned over the information about Duane Scott Jr. to the fire department.
"So far, they haven't been able to connect him to the crime," Jason Marshall said.
"Did they turn up any clues?"
"Well, nothing that panned out. Near the scene of the fire, they found a ballpoint pen with a name on it, Red Diamond Energy. Some oil and gas company from Tampa. There's a small lease out there near the swamp," Jason Marshall said. "Needless to say, young Mr. Scrout is not on their payroll. It's unlikely that the pen was his."
"So what happens to your arson case?"
"Not much, unless we catch a break."
Privately, Dr. Dressler was relieved that Duane Jr. wouldn't be arrested anytime soon, if at all. The ugly publicity would have been damaging to the reputation of the school. Years earlier, Truman's student had been caught driving a stolen snow cone truck, and it had made the TV news all the way over in Miami. "Do you want me to call you when Duane returns to class?" the headmaster asked Jason Marshall. "Would you still like to speak with him?"
"Might as well. Just let him know he's on our radar."
"Good idea," said Dr. Dressler, although he suspected that Duane Scott Jr. would not be even slightly intimidated. 8. The helicopter took off from Naples Airport and headed east. In the front passenger seat was a heavy-set man in his mid-30s named Drake McBride, the president of Red Diamond Energy Corporation. Sitting behind him was his project manager, Jimmy Lee Bayless. Both men had headsets with microphones attached so that they could hear each other over the din of the engines. Drake McBride wore a cowboy hat, snakeskin boots, and a pale silk shirt with snap buttons. He was sipping hot coffee from a styrofoam cup. Jimmy Lee Bayless was dressed in a tan, long-sleeved work shirt and smudged trousers. A map lay open across his lap. Within minutes, the helicopter was circling the Black Vine Swamp. Jimmy Lee Bayless pointed to a charred, crescent-shaped scar in a scruffy prairie that bordered the ancient cypress strand.
"That's from the fire," he said to his boss. "None of our equipment got damaged, right?" "Course not." Jimmy Lee Bayless thought, "Does he think I'm a moron?"
Drake McBride shielded his eyes from the glare of the sun.
"Section 22 is right below us?"
"Yes, sir."
"And Section 21 is over there."
"That's right,"
said Jimmy Lee Bayless. "Let me see the dang map."
Drake McBride was not a Texan, although he tried to dress like one and talk like one. It annoyed Jimmy Lee Bayless, who was from Houston and had spent 26 years of his life drilling for oil and natural gas. Drake McBride, on the other hand, was from upstate New York, and therefore had no business saying words like "danged." However, being a fairly intelligent fellow, Jimmy Lee Bayless knew better than to disrespect the person who signed his paychecks.
"Take us down to 200 feet, Drake McBride told the pilot.
Helicopter spooked some snowy egrets from the treetops, flushed a deer across the dry prairie.
"Any sign of that dang cat?"
Drake McBride asked Jimmy Lee Bayless.
"No, sir. The gunshot scared it off for good, I'm sure."
Jimmy Lee Bayless dug into his pants for a roll of Tums. Ever since he'd been assigned to the Big Cypress Project, his stomach burned like he'd swallowed a hot coal. Drake McBride said,
"Wouldn't have broke my heart if you'd blasted that hairball to smithereens."
"Law's pretty harsh when it comes to killing panthers. The feds got no sense of sport, sir."
"Panthers? Ha!"
Drake McBride snorted.
"Out west, they're just plain old cougars. You can shoot 'em down like coyotes."
He pronounced coyote with a long E on the end, which made Jimmy Lee Bayless cringe. He wasn't fond of phonies.
"If that cat comes back here and somebody spots it, we got a problem," Drake McBride said. "Last thing we need is nosy game wardens tramping all over our project site. You follow?"
"The path is long gone, sir. I fired 2 rounds over its head with a deer rifle, and you never saw anything run so fast in all your life. Wouldn't surprise me if it's still running."
"Hope you're right, friend."
"I hope so, too," thought Jimmy Lee Bayless. Panthers were Florida's most endangered species, and public sightings attracted lots of attention. Some overeager wildlife officer decided that Red Diamond's drilling activities were disturbing panther habitat. The whole project could be delayed or even shut down. The helicopter pilot made one more pass over the scene of the fire. Gazing down at the scorched grass and trees, Drake McBride slurped his coffee and said,
"Well, it's the dry season.
Jimmy Lee Bayless wasn't sure if his boss was trying to be funny.
Just go on doing what you've been doing, Drake McBride told him, and get us ready to rock and roll.
Yes, sir.
And don't forget.
I know,
Jimmy Lee Bayless said.
Keep a low profile.
Lower than a rattlesnake's belly, said Drake McBride.
Nick and his mother arrived home from Washington, D.C. on Sunday night. He got up early the next morning to get his arm taped. When he asked his mother for help, she looked doubtfully at the ace bandage and said, "What are the other kids going to say?" "I don't really care," said Nick. "I want to go through the same thing as Dad. He won't be home for a while. I need to get a head start. Nicky, please. Just wrap me up, Mom." As usual, Marta sat next to him on the school bus. She asked what had happened to his right arm, which was bound tightly behind his back beneath his shirt. The right sleeve of his blue school blazer hung limp. Nick said, "From now on, I'm doing everything left-handed." "Writing, too? What about baseball and lacrosse?" "Everything." Marta arched an eyebrow. "And there's nothing wrong with your other arm?" "Nope." "That's really whacked, Dick. That's like making fun of crippled people." His cheeks flushed. "No, just the opposite," he said sharply. "My dad got hurt real bad by a rocket in Iraq. He lost his right arm all the way past the shoulder." Marta gasped softly. "God, I am so sorry. Is he going to be all right?" Nick nodded tightly. "But he'll be a lefty the rest of his life." "So that's why you're switching?" Marta smiled and pinched the empty sleeve of his jacket. "Pretty cool."
"Whatever."
"I'm serious," she said. "When's he coming home?"
"Pretty soon, I hope."
Nick told her about the trip that he and his mother had made to the Walter Reed Military Hospital. "That's why I wasn't in school Thursday and Friday." Marta said, "Nobody told us. I thought you had the flu."
"I wish," he said glumly, and stayed quiet for the rest of the ride to Truman.
His first class of the day was English. The teacher, Mr. Grunwald, was giving a lecture about a famous short story called The Open Boat by Stephen Crane. Nick had finished reading it on the flight home from Washington. When he tried to get his binder out of his book bag, the zipper on the book pocket got stuck. It wouldn't have been a big deal if Nick's right arm hadn't been strapped behind him, but his weaker left hand couldn't loosen the zipper by itself. Every time he jerked on it, the backpack rose off the floor, and he lost his leverage. Mickey Maris was behind him, saw what was happening, and reached over to help. Nick waved him away. With grim determination, he planted both his feet on top of the backpack to hold it in place. Then he yanked with all his might on the zipper hitch, which instantly snapped off at his fingers. Nick grumbled under his breath. He tugged the book bag onto his lap, and using the tip of a ballpoint pen, separated the teeth of the broken zipper to open the stubborn book pocket. He removed the English binder, slapped it open on his desk, carefully positioned the pen in his left hand, and prepared to take notes.
"This famous tale of a shipwrecked crew," Mr. Grunwald began, "was based on a true episode in the young author's life."
Writing left-handed felt weird, like having a crab claw on the end of his arm. Nick tried hard to guide the pen smoothly. He was trying to spell out the words, "based on a true story." But on paper, the line came out looking like blue worm tracks, and a dizzy worm at that. Mickey Maris, who'd been peeking over Nick's shoulder, whispered,
"It's okay, dude. You can borrow my notes and scan a copy after school."
Nick firmly shook his head. "Thanks anyway." He wasn't about to give up so easily. By the end of the period, the letters he was stringing together with such difficulty actually began to resemble those in the English language. The next class was algebra, and its quirky formulas presented a different kind of challenge. Happily, Nick found the numerals and symbols easier to master with an untrained hand than the alphabet. By the time he got to biology, his left arm throbbed and his fingers were cramping. A substitute teacher stood writing on the board, his back to the students.
"Still no Mrs. Starch?" Nick whispered to Marta. "She took a leave of absence. You believe that?" Marta said. "Dr. Dressler made an announcement on Friday."
Strange, Nick thought.
"Did he say why?" "Family emergency, whatever that means."
Marta's cell phone began to vibrate and she turned it off.
"He did say that the old witch would be coming back, unfortunately."
Nick wrestled the biology book out of his backpack.
"What about Smoke?" he asked. "Nobody's seen him. He must have quit school or else Dressler kicked him out," Marta said. "Either way, no great loss."
"Maybe he got busted for setting the fire."
"Libby says no. Her dad's assigned to the case, so she would have heard about it," Marta said. "Hey, how's the arm feel, Lefty?"
"Excellent," Nick lied.
The substitute was spelling out his name in large block letters. "Dr. Wendell Waxmo." Marta inhaled through her teeth.
"No way. Not him," Nick murmured.
Wendell Waxmo was a legendary wacko. Nick and Marta had never had him as a teacher, but they'd heard all about him. Everybody had. Because of his peculiar behavior, Wendell Waxmo had been banned long ago from the public school system. However, since private schools such as Truman were usually desperate for substitutes, Wendell Waxmo still got the occasional call. The students let out a collective giggle when he turned to face them. Wendell Waxmo was wearing a faded black tuxedo with a bright yellow bow tie.
"All right, you little termites. What's so bloody funny?"
he asked in a squeaky, brittle voice that was impossible to take seriously. He looked half as tall and twice as wide as Mrs. Starch. His wispy red hair was arranged in a failed attempt to cover a bald spot the size of a dinner platter.
"Now please rise and sing the Pledge of Allegiance," he said.
The students glanced at each other uncertainly. Nobody stood up. When Graham raised his hand, Wendell Waxmo called on him with an impatient snap of the fingers.
"We only do the Pledge of Allegiance in morning assembly," Graham explained. "And we don't sing it, Mr. Waxmo."
"For me, you do."
So they all got up and sang the Pledge of Allegiance to the tune of America the Beautiful. It sounded totally ridiculous. The class sat down tittering. Wendell Waxmo announced that he'd be filling in for Mrs. Starch until her return. He also said that he wished to be addressed as Dr. Waxmo, as he'd received an advanced degree from Bittleburg State University. Nick had never heard of the school, although Dr. Waxmo described it as the Harvard of the Dakotas. Graham again started waving a hand.
"But now,"
Wendell Waxmo barked irritably,
"North Dakota or South Dakota?"
"Both, and western Minnesota as well,"
Wendell Waxmo said.
"Now open your textbooks to page 117. Today we're going to conjugate the verb amar, which of course means to love."
Libby Marshall couldn't contain herself.
"But this isn't Spanish class. It's biology," she blurted.
Wendell Waxmo's brow furrowed and he cocked his head.
"You think I was born yesterday? You think I just fell off the turnip truck? What's your name, young lady?"
Marta passed a note to Nick.
"This is fantastic. He's crazy as a bedbug."
Nick smiled and stuffed the note into his pocket. Libby Marshall was quaking under Wendell Waxmo's stare.
"I said, what's your name?"
he persisted. Nick raised his left hand and, not waiting to be called on, said,
"She's right, Dr. Waxmo. This is a biology class. See, here's our book."
Wendell Waxmore stalked up to Nick, snatched the text, thumbed through it grumpily, and shoved it back at him.
"There's one on Mrs. Starch's desk for you to use," Nick said.
Wendell Waxmore turned to see.
"So there is,"
he muttered, and spun back to face Nick.
"And your name, young man?"
"Nick Waters."
"What's the matter with your right arm, Mr. Waters?"
"Nothing. It's just an experiment," Nick said.
"I broke my right arm once. A dairy cow sat on it,"
Wendell Waxmore said gravely.
"Are you trying to be funny or something?"
"No, sir. It's a serious experiment." Marta started to raise her hand, but Nick shot her a look. He didn't want everybody in class talking about what had happened to his father.
"Well, you'd better hope that a cloven 500-pound beast never sits on you, Mr. Waters, because it's not humorous."
Wendell Waxmore strode to the front of the room and hoisted Mrs. Starch's book.
"All right, everybody, let's turn to page 117.
The students just sat there. They thought he was joking, but he wasn't.
"What are you people waiting for?"
he snapped.
"It's not the Spanish book, Dr. Waxmore,"
Libby Marshall said in a small but brave voice. Rachel spoke up.
"We're way past page 117.
"Is that right?"
Something resembling a smile crossed Wendell Waxmore's face.
"Obviously none of you have ever had the experience of being in my classes. Otherwise, you'd know that on Mondays I always teach page 117. And only page 117, regardless of the subject matter."
Nick had to bite his lip to keep from laughing.
"Earlier this morning, for example, at the Egmont Day School, I substituted in Miss McKay's Advanced World History section,"
Wendell Waxmore said.
"By the time the bell rang, every one of those students had practically memorized page 117 of their history book. And that was a map of the Roman Empire."
Substitutes were often flaky, but Wendell Waxmore was in a special category.
"Every teacher has a system that works best for them," he prattled on. "Mrs. Starch has hers. I have mine, which is pick a page, then focus, focus, focus."
He flipped open the biology text to page 117, skimmed a few paragraphs, looked up brightly, and asked,
"So, who can tell me how proteins function in a plasma membrane?"
For once, Graham was too flustered to raise his hand. Libby Marshall answered the question in a dull tone.
"Proteins release chemicals that allow certain cells to communicate with each other, and they also help move water and sugar through the membrane."
Dr. Wendell Waxmore was overjoyed.
"Now that's what I'm talking about, folks. This little spitfire is cooking with gas. I hope everybody's taking notes."
Marta cackled under her breath.
"What for? Mrs. Starch tested us on this stuff 3 weeks ago."
"Don't tell him," whispered Nick.
Whenever Wendell Waxmore spoke, his bony Adam's apple bobbed up and down, causing the yellow bow tie to jiggle.
"Quick now, what's a phospholipid molecule? You there?"
He pointed at Graham.
"Definition, please."
Graham looked helpless and lost.
"I forget," he said.
Wendell Waxmore frowned.
"Stand, young man."
Graham rose unsteadily.
"Yes, sir."
"Lullaby, please."
"But I don't know any lullabies,"
Graham said, on the verge of blubbering. Wendell Waxmore sighed.
"A day without music is a day without sunshine. Sing out to me, please." "Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mama's gonna buy you a minor bird. And if that minor bird don't talk, Mama's gonna buy you a cuckoo clock."
Marta leaned close to Nick and said,
"That's not how it goes.
No kidding. Wendell Waxmore wasn't exactly a born singer. After he finished warbling, the student sat in stunned relief that he mistook for appreciation.
Your turn, young fellow,
he said to Graham. No, I can't.
Pardon me?
I just can't, Graham said again. Wendell Waxmore folded his arms.
I'm in charge of this battleship.
Yes, sir.
And you will do as I say or face the consequences.
Graham was plainly frightened by the threat, even though substitute teachers had very little authority.
I think I remember what a phospholipid molecule is, he offered gamely.
Who cares? Now sing,
Wendell Waxmore said.
Hush, little baby,
Graham began with a pained grimace.
Don't you cry.
Suddenly the door banged open and a boy stepped into the classroom. Nick didn't recognize him at first. The boy's blazer was pressed and spotless, his khaki trousers were laundered and creased, and his necktie was perfectly knotted. His cheeks looked shiny and scrubbed. His hair was parted and neatly trimmed, and not a speck of grease or grime was visible on his hands.
And who would you be?
Dr. Wendell Waxmore demanded. I would be Dwayne Scrod, Jr., the boy replied. 9. Marta jotted another note to Nick.
He's scarier now than he was before.
Like Marta and the rest of the class, Nick couldn't stop staring at Smoke. The transformation was incredible. Wendell Waxmore said,
You're tardy, Mr. Scrod.
Sorry, my bike threw a rod. Smoke sat down his backpack and removed a thin plastic binder, which he presented to the substitute. Here's my essay, he said. 500 words, just like Mrs. Starch asked for. Actually, it's 508. A ripple of high amusement passed through the room. Wendell Waxmore opened the binder to the front page upon which the title of the essay had been centered. The Curse of the Persistent Pimple by Dwayne Scrod, Jr. Wendell Waxmore made the foolish mistake of saying the title aloud, which caused an avalanche of laughter. She told me to make it funny, Smoke said defensively. He seemed uncomfortable being so sharply dressed in the center of attention.
What kind of nonsense is this?
Wendell Waxmore rolled up the binder and shook it in the air. The tuxedo made him look like an orchestra conductor.
Are you telling me that Mrs. Starch assigned you to write a research paper about pimples? Get serious!
Despite the teacher's hostile attitude, Smoke remained surprisingly calm. You want me to read it or not?
Out loud, you mean?
Wendell Waxmore scowled.
I don't think so, Mr. Scrod. Take a seat.
With a sniff of distaste, Wendell Waxmore deposited the acne essay in his scuffed briefcase. Smoke sat down and, to the astonishment of his classmates, produced a pen and a notebook. In all the time that Nick had known the kid, he couldn't remember ever seeing him take notes.
It's not really him, Marta whispered. It's got to be an imposter.
Or a secret twin brother, Nick said. Dr. Wendell Waxmore seemed miffed that his limelight had been stolen. He scuttled up to Dwayne Scrod, Jr. and said,
Young man, I intend to find out if you're telling the truth about this preposterous pimple project, or if it's just some prank you thought up to have a few cheap giggles at my expense.
Smoke looked puzzled. Why would I do a dumbass thing like that?
Because kids always try to take advantage of substitute teachers, that's why. To prey on them, as it were. You think we're here just for your sport and entertainment?
Wendell Waxmore inched closer.
I know your type, son, he said, but I insist on respect. Why else would I go all the trouble of dressing up this way?
Smoke shrugged. Because you're a total whack job? The class exploded, and Wendell Waxmo turned purple. Then he did something that caused the students to swallow their laughter. He jabbed a pale, knobby finger at Smoke's nose.
"You," he said, seething, "owe me an apology."
Nick and the other students fully expected Smoke to chomp the substitute's offending finger in half, as he'd done to Mrs. Starch's yellow pencil. But Duane Scrod Jr. shocked them all. He didn't nip, nibble, or even spit on Wendell Waxmo. Instead, he clenched his jaws, took a slow, tight breath, and said, "You're right, bro. I'm sorry." Which prompted Marta to jot another frantic note to Nick.
"He's turned into an alien!"
If the truth were known, Dr. Dressler had the names of four other substitutes who were completely sane and normal. He chose Wendell Waxmo instead, knowing full well that the man was more or less out of his mind. It was Dr. Dressler's belief that once Bunny Starch found out who was teaching her classes, she would immediately terminate her leave of absence and rush back to rescue her students. In the meantime, the headmaster braced himself for angry phone calls from Truman parents complaining about Wendell Waxmo's distracting wardrobe, bizarre teaching style, and loony impulses to break out in song. For now, though, Dr. Dressler had a more pressing problem. "Would you care for some coffee?" he asked Jason Marshall. The detective said no thanks and took a seat.
"Have you spoken to him yet?"
"Not a word. He just showed up for class this morning," Dr. Dressler said, out of the blue.
"Did you notice anything different about him?"
Dr. Dressler chuckled uneasily. "Everything about him is different. He's like a whole new person."
"What do you mean?" the detective asked.
"He looks like a real student, is what I mean. He looks like he actually wants to be here."
"That's a good thing, right?"
"Certainly," Dr. Dressler said, though privately he was both alarmed and suspicious. When the bell rang, he nervously poured himself another cup of coffee. "You'll see for yourself," he said to Jason Marshall. Moments later, Duane Scrod Jr. walked into the office. He didn't look like an arsonist. He looked like the future president of the student council. He also appeared perfectly fit and healthy, despite having digested Mrs. Starch's pencil. Dr. Dressler introduced Detective Marshall. "He'd like to ask you a few questions, Duane." "No problem." Duane Scrod Jr. made himself comfortable on the headmaster's leather sofa. Jason Marshall took out a legal pad.
"I heard about the incident with Mrs. Starch," he began.
Duane Scrod Jr. didn't deny it. "Is it against the law to bite a pencil?"
"Some of the other kids said you also threatened her," the detective said.
"She was making fun of me. I guess I got mad," the boy admitted. "I told her she'd be sorry if she didn't get out of my face. It was wrong, what I said, definitely."
"So you didn't mean it?"
"Of course not."
Jason Marshall wrote down Duane Jr.'s answers. Dr. Dressler couldn't get over how normal the boy looked. He couldn't imagine what had caused such a dramatic change in grooming and attitude. "Yet the next day you didn't come to school," the detective said.
"Yeah, I skipped. That was wrong, too," Duane Scrod Jr. said.
"Have you ever been out to the Black Vine Swamp?"
"Sure, catching snakes."
"Did you go there on the day of the class field trip?" The boy seemed to be expecting the question.
"No, I went snook fishing down at Marco. There was a mullet run and a big tide. You can ask Benji Osceola. He was on the other end of the bridge."
Duane Scrod Jr.'s story sounded convincing to Dr. Dressler, but the detective wasn't finished.
"Duane, I want to ask you something, and you got to promise not to get upset. It's my job, okay?"
"No sweat."
Did you sneak out to the Blackvine Swamp and set a fire to scare Mrs. Starch during the field trip? The boy was true to his word. He stayed cool. He looked Jason Marshall straight in the eye and said, I don't do that stuff anymore. So the answer is no, most definitely. Did you do anything during the last few days that might have frightened Mrs. Starch into believing your threat was real? She hasn't been back to school since the field trip. Dwayne Scrod Jr. laughed. That lady's not scared of anything, especially a kid. I don't want no more trouble from her. That's how come I did that stupid essay she wanted. Sorry, but it was stupid. Dr. Dressler felt obliged to ask, what kind of essay? Dwayne Jr. rolled his eyes. She made me write 500 words about zits. The headmaster winced. Seriously, the boy said. Dr. Dressler made a mental note to have a diplomatic chat with Mrs. Starch when she returned to school. Disciplining a student was one thing, humiliating him was another. The detective had heard enough about the pimple paper. I'm about done here, he said. Thanks for stopping by, Dwayne. The boy rose from the couch. Just a second. I have one question, Dr. Dressler said. Dwayne Scott Jr. turned, a trace of impatience in his eyes. The headmaster said, I'm just curious, Dwayne. Did something in particular happen to bring about this major change in you? What do you mean? Dr. Dressler smiled in a way that he hoped would appear friendly and genuine. The way you're dressed, the way you're acting. Surely you're aware of the difference? Wayne Scott Jr. looked down at himself and scratched pensively at a radish-colored blemish on his neck. I went camping for a few nights. Had tons of time to think about stuff. What kind of stuff? Asked Jason Marshall. The way I was headed, mistakes I kept making, all those wrong turns. Even the detective seemed touched. That's just part of growing up, he said. Yeah, well, it gets old, the boy remarked, not caring about a damn thing in the world. So I decided to try it the other way. Dr. Dressler nodded sympathetically. Well, we like the new you, Dwayne. It's a solid move, Jason Marshall agreed. I guess, said Dwayne Scott Jr., and excused himself. Dinner was a challenge. I should have made fried chicken, Nick's mother said. Something you could pick up with your fingers. It's okay, I need to nail this. Nick was eyeing the pork chop on his plate, trying to figure out how to cut it. He was able to work the knife pretty well with his left hand, but he couldn't keep the meat from sliding around without his other hand there to pin it down with a fork. Let me unwrap your right arm, his mom implored, just for tonight. No way. This is how Dad's got to do it, right? Nick's mother said, I'd cut his food if he were home. You can bet on that. The disappointing news had come in a phone call that afternoon. Captain Gregory Waters was fighting an infection in his wounded shoulder. The doctor had told Nick's mother that his dad was responding slowly to the antibiotics. On a more positive note, the doctor reported that Captain Waters' early rehab sessions were outstanding. Nick was pleased, though not surprised. His father had always kept himself in top physical shape. How come they wouldn't let us talk to him? Nick asked. Because he was sleeping. They said he did 2 hours with his left arm on the weight machine this afternoon. That sounds like Captain Studley. It does indeed. Nick's mom was watching the pork chop skate back and forth across his plate while he hacked at it with the knife. You're going to starve to death, Nicky. Let me do that, she said. No, I'll get the hang of it. In frustration, he put down the knife and reached for a bread roll, which he gobbled in 3 bites. It's only my first day left-handed, he mumbled through the crumbs. You mean one-handed, his mother said. What did the other kids have to say?
Not much. Marta thought it was cool. How was P.E.?
Fine,
Nick said, which wasn't even remotely true. Lacrosse was extremely difficult to play with your best arm bound behind your back, and Nick had been practically useless to his team. Later, while he was in the shower, two of the seniors had snatched his ace bandage from the towel rack and used it to hogtie an overweight, slow-footed freshman named Pudge Powell IV. Two coaches spent 10 minutes unbinding the boy. So, P.E. class basically had been a disaster. His mother said, "You're going to be hurting tomorrow. You want to take a hot bath." Nick didn't argue, though he was embarrassed to admit how sore he was. And it wasn't as if he'd been chopping wood all day. The routine tasks of taking notes, carrying a backpack, opening a few doors, and swinging a lacrosse stick had worn him out. Never again would he take for granted the luxury of having two good arms. After soaking for half an hour and then rewrapping himself, Nick confronted his homework, which included 18 algebra problems. At one point, his mom came into the room and peeked over his left shoulder.
"I'm impressed. I can actually read your answers," she said. "I've got no idea if they're right or wrong, but I can definitely read them."
"Just wait.
Can I ask you something, Nicky? How long are you going to keep up this lefty routine?"
"Until I get good at it." "Then what?"
"I don't know, Mom," Nick said shortly. "I haven't thought about it." In fact, he thought about it plenty. The doctors had said the Nick's father would face months of outpatient rehab after returning home. Nick planned to be there with him, practicing all the same left-handed exercises. After finishing his math homework, Nick read an O. Henry story for English class, which improved his mood. Then he tackled the chore of brushing his teeth, causing only minor bleeding from his gums. He planned to go to bed with his right arm wrapped, but he couldn't get comfortable. His hand kept falling asleep, and Nick became worried that the elastic bandage might cause permanent damage if he dozed off in the wrong position. With some effort, he unstrapped the arm, which felt weak and numb. He made a fist and flexed the muscle several times to get the blood circulating again. Nick already had the lights off and was listening to his iPod when his mother cracked the door. She said,
"Wow, it's only 8:30.
"I'm whipped." She sat down and laid a hand on his forehead, checking to see if he had a temperature. He told her he was fine. "You bummed about Dad?" she asked. Nick nodded. "Yeah, it sucks. We'll call him tomorrow, I promise." "The infection must be pretty bad." Nick's mother told him not to worry. The doctor said it happens sometimes after a combat amputation. A last word jolted Nick. The truth was still sinking in. His father was an amputee.
"But at least he's alive," Nick said to himself. "And that's what really matters."
His mother said, "I'll be up watching TV for a while in case you can't sleep."
"Thanks, Mom, but I'm ready to crash."
An hour later, Nick was still wide awake. His body was exhausted, but his brain was sparking like a high-voltage wire. He couldn't stop thinking about what had happened to his father, imagining the flash from the exploding rocket, the blast of the Humvee bursting into pieces, the flames and the smoke and screams. Afraid of what he might dream if he shut his eyes, Nick grabbed his cell phone off the nightstand and dialed Marta's number. She answered on the second ring.
"You awake?" he said, keeping his voice low.
"Surfing Facebook. How lame is that?"
"Extremely," Nick said.
"You talk to your dad?"
"Not today. He was rehabbing."
Marta said, "I can't sleep either. I've been thinking about everything that's been happening at school, and here's what I figured out. Mrs. Starch is a witch."
"Not this again."
"No, I mean a real witch. Think about it. She and Smoke dropped out of sight at about the same time. Suddenly he's back in school, and it's like he got a complete personality transplant. I bet Mrs. Starch put a spell on him."
Nick laughed. "This isn't Hogwarts, Marta.
It's the Truman School.
I didn't say she was a wizard. I said she was a witch.
Whatever.
Okay, smartass, let's hear your brilliant theory.
I don't have one, Nick admitted. Something weird's going on, that's for sure.
Thank you, Marta said.
Nick agreed that Mrs. Starch's excuse for taking a leave of absence from school, the so-called family emergency, sounded bogus. The woman hadn't missed a day of teaching since the Stone Age. Yet even more startling and suspicious had been the appearance in class of the new improved Duane Scrod, Jr. Alert, neatly combed and dressed, academically responsible, a complete stranger, basically. Nick had the uneasy sense of being in one of those short stories that led you off in one direction, then ended someplace else with a total surprise. And the weirdness had all started on the day that Smoke ate Mrs. Starch's pencil. Marta said, "Are you sitting down?"
"I'm lying down in bed."
"Good. Guess what I saw this afternoon after school? Remember that blue Prius with the Save the Manatee license plate? The one just like Mrs. Starch's car?" "Well, guess what? It was Mrs. Starch's car. Had to be."
"How do you know?" Nick asked skeptically.
"Because I saw it flying out of the parking lot of Ace Hardware going like 50 miles an hour. And guess who was chugging a Mountain Dew in the passenger seat?"
"Smoke."
"Get out," Nick said.
"Swear to God, in his Truman blazer."
"But who was driving?"
"Looked like a guy with a black ski beanie pulled tight over his head. But I bet it was Mrs. Starch."
"You know, witches could change themselves into anything," Marta said confidently.
"Yeah, well, who changed you into a space case? There's no such thing as witches, so knock it off."
There was silence on the other end of the line. Nick was worried that he'd hurt his friend's feelings.
Marta said, "You don't believe me."
"I just don't believe in all that Harry Potter stuff, okay?
But I do believe you saw smoke in the blue car today," Nick said.
"And I also believe the car belonged to Mrs. Starch. It's just too freaky to be a coincidence."
Marta was relieved that Nick didn't think she'd made the whole thing up.
"So what do we do now?"
"Now," said Nick, "now we've got to find out who's driving smoke around town in Mrs. Starch's car and what they've done with Mrs. Starch."
"Awesome."
Although Nick stayed awake for a while longer, his imagination was no longer consumed by the Baghdad rocket attack that had maimed his father. Instead, he was thinking about the Black Vine Swamp and what secrets it might hold. 10. Nobody saw the helicopter land because no bus tours or school classes were visiting the Black Vine Swamp that morning. Drake McBride stepped from the chopper and hurried toward a truck that had the Red Diamond logo painted on its doors. Jimmy Lee Bayless emerged from the driver's side and greeted his boss with a grim nod.
"What in creation happened out here?" Drake McBride asked.
"Pretty much what I told you on the phone."
"Is that him?"
Drake McBride jerked his chin toward a figure huddled inside the truck.
"Yes, sir," said Jimmy Lee Bayless.
He opened the passenger door, and an unhappy-looking young man got out. It was impossible not to notice that he was stark naked under a makeshift robe of clear bubble wrap, the same sort of material used to pack valuables for shipping.
"What the heck?"
Drake McBride exclaimed. "It was all I had in the truck," Jimmy Lee Bayless said. "That's why I asked you to bring some extra clothes." Drake McBride shrugged.
"Well, I forgot." Addressing the bubble-wrap man, he said, "What's your name, son?"
"Melton."
"How long you been with us?"
3 weeks is all," Melton said.
"So you're not on full benefits yet," Drake McBride said. "But don't you worry. We'll make sure all your doctor bills are covered at least 60%. Did they hurt you?"
"Not really, but some bull ants chewed up my butt cheeks pretty fierce." Jimmy Lee Bayless said, "Go on, tell Mr. McBride what happened. He's a busy man." Melton didn't seem especially impressed that he was speaking to the president of the company. He looked like he wished he'd never heard of the Red Diamond Energy Corporation.
"I was out here stacking some pipe," he said, "when they jumped me from behind. Next thing I know, I'm glued to a cypress tree, and I can't pull free."
"In your birthday suit," Drake McBride said.
"Yeah, they stole my clothes."
"The pipes, too," said Jimmy Lee Bayless, who'd already eaten an entire roll of Tums since breakfast. He longed to be back in Texas, enjoying the retired life. On his fingers, Drake McBride began ticking off the crimes committed against poor Melton.
"So there's assault, grand theft, indecent whatever. How many of them were there, son?"
"I don't know."
"Or how many did you see?"
"One," Melton said. "But there's had to be more. Ain't no way just one guy could take me."
Jimmy Lee Bayless didn't say so, but he believed it was entirely possible for one physically fit man to have overpowered the scrawny, chain-smoking Melton. Drake McBride pulled Jimmy Lee Bayless aside.
"Obviously we can't tell the police this happened in Section 22, so we're going to tell them it was Section 21, where we're legal. I want you to make sure the young fella gets his story straight."
"Lying to the cops is too risky,"
Jimmy Lee Bayless warned his boss.
"Especially if we rely on Melton. The kid's got the IQ of a baked potato. He'd liable to say anything."
Drake McBride let out an aggravated sigh.
"We're not supposed to set foot in Section 22, much less be digging a pit and laying pipe. What other choice do we have, Jimmy, but to lie?"
"That's easy. Don't call the cops."